Chapter 5. Mr. Julius P. Hirschheimer.
"Well," said Tuppence, recovering herself, "it really seems as though it were meant to be."
Cotter nodded. "I know what you mean. I'm superstitious myself, luck and all that sort of thing. Fate seems to have chosen you out to be mixed up in this."
Tommy indulged in a chuckle.
"My word, I don't wonder Whittington got the wind up when Tuppence plumped out that name. I should have myself. But look here, sir, we're taking up an awful lot of your time. Have you any tips to give us before we clear out?"
"I think not. My experts, working in stereotyped ways, have failed. You will bring imagination and an open mind to the task. Don't be discouraged if that, too, does not succeed. For one thing, there is a likelihood of the pace being forced."
Tuppence frowned uncomprehendingly.
"When you had that interview with Whittington, they had time before them. I have information that the big coup was planned for early in the new year. But the government is contemplating legislative action which will deal effectually with the strike menace. They'll get wind of it soon, if they haven't already, and it's possible that that may bring things to a head. I hope it will, myself. The less time they have to mature their plans, the better. I'm just warning you that you haven't much time before you, and that you needn't be cast down if you fail. It's not an easy proposition anyway. That's all."
Tuppence rose.
"I think we ought to be businesslike. What exactly can we count upon you for, Mr. Carter?"
Mr. Carter's lips twitched slightly, but he replied succinctly,
"Funds within reason, detailed information on any point, and no official recognition. I mean that if you get yourselves into trouble with the police, I can't officially help you out of it. You're on your own."
Tuppence nodded sagely.
"I quite understand that. I'll write out a list of the things I want to know when I've had time to think. Now, about money."
"Yes, Miss Tuppence. Do you want to say how much?"
"Not exactly. We've got plenty to go with for the present, but when we want more..."
"It will be waiting for you."
"Yes, but I'm sure I don't want to be rude about the government if you've got anything to do with it, but you know one really has the devil of a time getting anything out of it. And if we have to fill up a blue form and send it in, and then after 3 months they send us a green one and so on, well, that won't be much use, will it?"
Mr. Carter laughed outright.
"Ah, don't worry, Miss Tuppence. You will send a personal demand to me here, and the money, in notes, shall be sent by return of post. As to salary, shall we say, at the rate of 300 a year? And an equal sum for Mr. Beresford, of course."
Tuppence beamed upon him.
"How lovely! You are kind. I do love money. I'll keep beautiful accounts of our expenses, all debit and credit and the balance on the right side, and a red line drawn sideways with the totals the same at the bottom. I really know how to do it when I think."
"I'm sure you do. Well, goodbye, and good luck to you both." He shook hands with them, and in another minute they were descending the steps of 27 Carshalton Terrace with their heads in a whirl.
"Tommy, tell me at once, who is Mr. Carter?"
Tommy murmured a name in her ear.
"Oh," said Tuppence, impressed.
"And I can tell you, old bean, he's it."
"Oh," said Tuppence again. Then she added reflectively, "I like him, don't you? He looks so awfully tired and bored, and yet you feel that underneath he's just like steel, all keen and flashing. Oh," she gave a skip, "pinch me, Tommy. Do pinch me. I can't believe it's real."
Mr. Beresford obliged.
"Ow! That's enough. Yes, we're not dreaming. We've got a job."
"And what a job! The joint venture has really begun."
"It's more respectable than I thought it would be," said Tuppence thoughtfully.
"Luckily, I haven't got your craving for crime. What time is it? Let's have lunch. Oh!" The same thought sprang to the minds of each. Tommy voiced it first. "Julius P. Hirschheimer.
We never told Mr. Carter about hearing from him."
"Well, there wasn't much to tell, not till we've seen him. Come on, we'd better take a taxi."
"Now who's being extravagant?"
"All expenses paid, remember. Hop in."
"At any rate, we shall make a better effect arriving this way," said Tuppence, leaning back luxuriously. "I'm sure blackmailers never arrive in buses."
"We've ceased being blackmailers," Tommy pointed out.
"I'm not sure I have," said Tuppence darkly.
On inquiring for Mr. Hirschheimer, they were at once taken up to his suite.
An impatient voice cried, "Come in!" in answer to the page boy's knock, and the lad stood aside to let them pass in. Mr. Julius P. Hirschheimer was a great deal younger than either Tommy or Tuppence had pictured him. The girl put him down as 35. He was of middle height and squarely built to match his jaw. His face was pugnacious but pleasant. No one could have mistaken him for anything but an American, though he spoke with very little accent. "Get my note? Sit down and tell me right away all you know about my cousin." "Your cousin? Sure thing, Jane Finn." "Is she your cousin?"
"My father and her mother were brother and sister,"
explained Mr. Hirschheimer meticulously.
"Oh!" cried Tuppence. "Then you know where she is."
"No!" Mr. Hirschheimer brought down his fist with a bang on the table. "I'm darned if I do, don't you?"
"We advertised to receive information, not to give it," said Tuppence severely.
"I guess I know that. I can read. But I thought maybe it was her back history you were after, and that you'd know where she was now."
"Well, we wouldn't mind hearing her back history," said Tuppence guardedly. But Mr. Hirschheimer seemed to grow suddenly suspicious.
"See here," he declared, "this isn't Sicily. No demanding ransom or threatening to crop her ears if I refuse. These are the British Isles, so quit the funny business, or I'll just sing out for that beautiful big British policeman I see out there in Piccadilly."
Tommy hastened to explain.
"We haven't kidnapped your cousin. On the contrary, we're trying to find her. We're employed to do so."
Mr. Hirschheimer leant back in his chair.
"Put me wise," he said succinctly.
Tommy fell in with this demand, insofar as he gave him a guarded version of the disappearance of Jane Finn, and of the possibility of her having been mixed up unawares in some political show. He alluded to Tuppence and himself as private inquiry agents commissioned to find her, and added that they would therefore be glad of any details Mr. Hirschheimer could give them. That gentleman nodded approval.
"I guess that's all right. I was just a mite hasty. But London gets my goat. I only know little old New York. Just trot out your questions and I'll answer."
For the moment this paralysed the young adventurers, but Tuppence, recovering herself, plunged boldly into the breach with a reminiscence culled from detective fiction.
"When did you last see the your cousin, I mean?"
"Never seen her," responded Mr. Hirschheimer. "What?"
demanded Tommy, astonished. Hirschheimer turned to him.
"No, sir. As I said before, my father and her mother were brother and sister, just as you might be."
Tommy did not correct this view of their relationship.
"They didn't always get on together. And when my poor aunt made up her mind to marry Amos Finn, who was a poor schoolteacher out west, my father was just mad. Said if he made his pile, as he seemed in a fair way to do, she'd never see a cent of it. Well, the upshot was that Aunt Jane went out west, and we never heard from her again. The old man did pile it up. He went into oil, and he went into steel, and he played a bit with railroads. And I can tell you, he made Wall Street sit up." He paused. "Then he died, last fall, and I got the dollars. Well, would you believe it, my conscience got busy. Kept knocking me up and saying, 'What about your Aunt Jane, way out west?' It worried me some. You see, I figured it out that Amos Finn would never make good. He wasn't the sort. And if it was, I hired a man to hunt her down. Result, she was dead, and Amos Finn was dead, but they'd left a daughter, Jane, who'd been torpedoed in the Lusitania on her way to Paris. She was saved, all right, but they didn't seem able to hear of her over this side. I guess they weren't hustling any, so I thought I'd come along over and speed things up. I phoned Scotland Yard and the Admiralty first thing. The Admiralty rather choked me off, but Scotland Yard were very civil, said they would make inquiries, even sent a man round this morning to get her photograph. I'm off to Paris tomorrow just to see what the prefecture is doing. I guess if I go to and fro hustling them, they ought to get busy."
The energy of Mr. Hirschheimer was tremendous. They bowed before it.
"But say now," he ended, "you're not after her for anything? Contempt of court or something British? A proud-spirited young American girl might find your rules and regulations in wartime rather irksome and get up against it. If that's the case, and there's such a thing as graft in this country, I'll buy her off."
Tuppence reassured him.
"That's good. Then we can work together. What about some lunch? Shall we have it up here, or go down to the restaurant?"
Tuppence expressed a preference for the latter, and Julius bowed to her decision. Oysters had just given way to Sol Colbert when a card was brought to Hersheimer. "Inspector Japp, CID, Scotland Yard again? Another man this time. What does he expect? I can tell him that I didn't tell the first chap. I hope they hadn't lost that photograph. That Western photographer's place was burned down and all his negatives destroyed. This is the only copy in existence. I got it from the principal of the college there."
An unformulated dread swept over Tuppence. You don't know the name of the man who came this morning?"
"Yes, I do." "No, I don't. Half a second. It was on his card. Oh, I know. Inspector Brown. Quiet, unassuming sort of chap."
Chapter 6. A Plan of Campaign. A veil might with profit be drawn over the events of the next half hour. Suffice it to say that no such person as Inspector Brown was known to Scotland Yard. The photograph of Jane Finn, which would have been of the utmost value to the police in tracing her, was lost beyond recovery. Once again, Mr. Brown had triumphed. The immediate result of this setback was to effect a rapprochement between Julius Hersheimer and the young adventurers. All barriers went down with a crash, and Tommy and Tuppence felt they had known the young American all their lives. They abandoned the discreet reticence of private inquiry agents and revealed to him the whole history of the joint venture, whereat the young man declared himself tickled to death. He turned to Tuppence at the close of the narration.
"I've always had a kind of idea that English girls were just a mite moss-grown. Old-fashioned and sweet, you know, but scared to move round without a footman or a maiden aunt. I guess I'm a bit behind the times."
The upshot of these confidential relations was that Tommy and Tuppence took up their abode forthwith at the Ritz, in order, as Tuppence put it, to keep in touch with Jane Finn's only living relation. "And put like that," she added confidentially to Tommy, "nobody could boggle at the expense." And nobody did, which was the great thing. "And now," said the young lady, on the morning after their installation, "to work." Mr. Beresford put down the Daily Mail, which he was reading, and applauded with somewhat unnecessary vigour. He was politely requested by his colleague not to be an ass.
"Dash it all, Tommy! We've got to do something for our money."
Tommy sighed.
"Yes, I fear even the dear old government will not support us at the Ritz in idleness forever.
Therefore, as I said before, we must do something."
"Well," said Tommy, picking up the Daily Mail again, "do it. I shan't stop you."
"You see," continued Tuppence, "I've been thinking—"
She was interrupted by a fresh bout of applause.
"It's all very well for you to sit there being funny, Tommy. It won't do you no harm to do a little brain work, too."
"My union, Tuppence, my union, does not permit me to work before 11 a.m.
Tommy, do you want something thrown at you? It is absolutely essential that we should, without delay, map out a plan of campaign."
"Hear, hear."
"Well, let's do it."
Tommy laid his paper finally aside.
"There's something of the simplicity of the truly great mind about you, Tuppence. Fire ahead. I'm listening."
"To begin with," said Tuppence, "what have we got to go upon?"
"Absolutely nothing," said Tommy cheerily.
"Wrong." Tuppence wagged an energetic finger. "We have two distinct clues."
"What are they?"
"First clue, we know one of the gang."
"Whittington?"
"Yes, I'd recognize him anywhere."
"Hmm," said Tommy doubtfully. "I don't call that much of a clue. You don't know where to look for him, and it's about 1,000 to 1 against your running against him by accident."
"I'm not so sure about that," replied Tuppence thoughtfully. "I've often noticed that once coincidences start happening, they go on happening in the most extraordinary way. I dare say it's some natural law that we haven't found out. Still, as you say, we can't rely on that. But there are places in London where simply everyone is bound to turn up sooner or later. Piccadilly Circus, for instance. One of my ideas was to take up my stand there every day with a tray of flags."
"What about meals?" inquired the practical Tommy.
"How like a man! What does mere food matter?"
"That's all very well. You've just had a thundering good breakfast. No one's got a better appetite than you have, Tuppence. By tea-time you'd be eating the flags, pins and all."
But honestly, I don't think much of the idea. Whittington mayn't be in London at all.
That's true. Anyway, I think clue number two is more promising.
Let's hear it.
It's nothing much, only a Christian name, Rita. Whittington mentioned it that day.
Are you proposing a third advertisement? Wanted female crook answering to the name of Rita?
I am not. I propose to reason in a logical manner. That man Danvers was shadowed on the way over, wasn't he? And it's more likely to have been a woman than a man.
I don't see that at all.
I'm absolutely certain that it would be a woman, and a good-looking one, replied Tuppence calmly.
On these technical points I bow to your decision, murmured Mr. Beresford.
Now, obviously this woman, whoever she was saved.
How do you make that out?
If she wasn't, how would they have known Jane Finn had got the papers?
Correct. Proceed, O Sherlock.
Now, there's just a chance, I admit it's only a chance, that this woman may have been Rita.
And if so?
If so, we've got to hunt through the survivors of the Lusitania till we find her.
Then the first thing is to get a list of the survivors.
I've got it. I wrote a long list of the things I wanted to know and sent it to Mr. Carter. I got his reply this morning, and, among other things, it encloses the official statement of those saved from the Lusitania. How's that for clever little Tuppence?
4 marks for industry, 0 for modesty. But the great point is there a Rita on the list?
That's just what I don't know, confessed Tuppence.
Don't know?
Yes. Look here. Together they bent over the list. You see, very few Christian names are given. They're nearly all Mrs. or Miss.
Tommy nodded. That complicates matters, he murmured thoughtfully.
Tuppence gave her characteristic terrier shake. Well, we've just got to get down to it, that's all. We'll start with the London area. Just note down the addresses of any of the females who live in London or roundabout while I put on my hat.
5 minutes later the young couple emerged into Piccadilly, and a few seconds later a taxi was bearing them to the Laurels, Glendower Road, North Severn, the residence of Mrs. Edgar Keith, whose name figured first in a list of 7 reposing in Tommy's pocket-book. The Laurels was a dilapidated house standing back from the road, with a few grimy bushes to support the fiction of a front garden. Tommy paid off the taxi and accompanied Tuppence to the front door bell. As she was about to ring it, he arrested her hand.
"What are you going to say?"
"What am I going to say? Why, I shall say—' "Oh, dear, I don't know. It's very awkward."
"I thought as much," said Tommy with satisfaction. "How like a woman! No foresight! Now just stand aside and see how easily the mere male deals with a situation."
He pressed the bell. Tuppence withdrew to a suitable spot. A slatternly-looking servant with an extremely dirty face and a pair of eyes that did not match answered the door. Tommy had produced a notebook and pencil.
"Good morning," he said, briskly and cheerfully. "From the Hampstead Borough Council, the new voting register. Mrs. Edgar Keith lives here, does she not?"
"Yes," said the servant.
"Christian name?" asked Tommy, his pencil poised.
"Mrs. Eleanor Jane."
"E-L-E-A-N-O-R," spelt Tommy. "Any sons or daughters over 21?
"No."
"Thank you."
Tommy closed the notebook with a brisk snap. "Good morning." The servant volunteered her first remark.
"I thought perhaps as you'd come about the gas," she observed cryptically, and shut the door.
Tommy rejoined his accomplice.
"You see, Tuppence," he observed, "child's play to the masculine mind."
"I don't mind admitting that for once you've scored handsomely. I should never have thought of that."
"Good wheeze, wasn't it? And we can repeat it ad lib."
Lunchtime found the young couple attacking a steak and chips in an obscure hostelry with avidity. They had collected a Gladys Mary and a Marjorie, been baffled by one change of address, and had been forced to listen to a long lecture on universal suffrage from a vivacious American lady whose Christian name had proved to be Sadie.
"Ah," said Tommy, imbibing a long draught of beer, "I feel better. Where's the next draw?"
The notebook lay on the table between them. Tuppence picked it up.
"Mrs. Vandermeer," she read, 20 South Audley Mansions, Miss Wheeler, 43 Clappington Road, Battersea,
She's a lady's maid, as far as I remember, so probably won't be there, and anyway she's not likely.
Then the Mayfair lady is clearly indicated as the first port of call.
Tommy, I'm getting discouraged.
Back up, old bean. We always knew it was an outside chance, and anyway we're only starting. If we draw a blank in London, there's a fine tour of England, Ireland, and Scotland before us.
True, said Tuppence, her flagging spirits reviving, and all expenses paid. But, oh, Tommy, I do like things to happen quickly. So far adventure has succeeded adventure, but this morning has been dull as dull.
You must stifle this longing for vulgar sensation, Tuppence. Remember that if Mr. Brown is all he is reported to be, it's a wonder that he has not ere now done us to death. And that's a good sentence, quite a literary flavour about it.
You're really more conceited than I am, with less excuse. But it certainly is queer that Mr. Brown has not yet wreaked vengeance upon us. You see, I can do it too. We pass on our way unscathed.
Perhaps he doesn't think us worth bothering about, suggested the young man simply.
Tuppence received the remark with great disfavour. How horrid you are, Tommy! Just as though we didn't count.
Sorry, Tuppence, what I meant was that we work like moles in the dark, and that he has no suspicion of our nefarious schemes. Ha ha!
Ha ha! Echoed Tuppence approvingly as she rose. South Audley Mansions was an imposing-looking block of flats just off Park Lane. Number 20 was on the second floor. Tommy had by this time the glibness born of practice. He rattled off the formula to the elderly woman, looking more like a housekeeper than a servant, who opened the door to him.
"Christian name?"
"Margaret."
Tommy spelt it, but the other interrupted him. "No, G-U-E." "Oh, Marguerite, French way, I see."
He paused, then plunged boldly.
"We had her down as Rita Vandermeer, but I suppose that's incorrect.
She's mostly called that, sir, but Marguerite's her name."
"Thank you. That's all. Good morning."
Hardly able to contain his excitement, Tommy hurried down the stairs. Tuppence was waiting at the angle of the turn.
"You heard?"
"Yes. Oh, Tommy!" Tommy squeezed her arm sympathetically.
"I know, old thing. I feel the same.
It's so lovely to think of things and then for them really to happen," cried Tuppence enthusiastically. Her hand was still in Tommy's. They had reached the entrance hall. There were footsteps on the stairs above them and voices. Suddenly, to Tommy's complete surprise, Tuppence dragged him into the little space by the side of the lift where the shadow was deepest.
"What the... Hush!"
Two men came down the stairs and passed out through the entrance. Tuppence's hand closed tighter on Tommy's arm.
"Quick! Follow them. I daren't. He might recognise me. I don't know who the other man is, but the bigger of the two was Whittington."
Chapter 7. The House in Soho. Whittington and his companion were walking at a good pace. Tommy started in pursuit at once, and was in time to see them turn the corner of the street. His vigorous strides soon enabled him to gain upon them, and by the time he, in his turn, reached the corner, the distance between them was sensibly lessened. The small Mayfair streets were comparatively deserted, and he judged it wise to content himself with keeping them in sight. The sport was a new one to him. Though familiar with the technicalities from a course of novel reading, he had never before attempted to follow anyone, and it appeared to him at once that in actual practice the proceeding was fraught with difficulties. Supposing, for instance, that they should suddenly hail a taxi. In books, you simply leapt into another, promised the driver a sovereign, or its modern equivalent, and there you were. In actual fact, Tommy foresaw that it was extremely likely there would be no second taxi, therefore he would have to run. What happened, in actual fact, to a young man who ran incessantly and persistently through the London streets? In a main road he might hope to create the illusion that he was merely running for a bus, but in these obscure aristocratic byways he could not but feel that an officious policeman might stop him to explain matters. At this juncture in his thoughts, a taxi with flag erect turned the corner of the street ahead. Tommy held his breath. Would they hail it? He drew a sigh of relief as they allowed it to pass unchallenged. Their course was a zigzag one, designed to bring them as quickly as possible to Oxford Street. When at length they turned into it, proceeding in an easterly direction, Tommy slightly increased his pace. Little by little he gained upon them. On the crowded pavement there was little chance of his attracting their notice, and he was anxious, if possible, to catch a word or two of their conversation. In this he was completely foiled. They spoke low, and the din of the traffic drowned their voices effectually. Just before the Bond Street tube station they crossed the road, Tommy, unperceived, faithfully at their heels, and entered the Big Lions. There they went up to the first floor and sat at a small table in the window. It was late, and the place was thinning out. Tommy took a seat at the table next to them, sitting directly behind Whittington in case of recognition. On the other hand, he had a full view of the second man, and studied him attentively. He was fair, with a weak, unpleasant face, and Tommy put him down as being either a Russian or a Pole. He was probably about 50 years of age. His shoulders cringed a little as he talked, and his eyes, small and crafty, shifted unceasingly. Having already lunched heartily, Tommy contented himself with ordering a Welsh rarebit and a cup of coffee. Whittington ordered a substantial lunch for himself and his companion. Then, as the waitress withdrew, he moved his chair a little closer to the table and began to talk earnestly in a low voice. The other man joined in. Listen as he would, Tommy could only catch a word here and there, but the gist of it seemed to be some directions or orders which the big man was impressing on his companion, and with which the latter seemed from time to time to disagree. Whittington addressed the other as Boris. Tommy caught the word Ireland several times, also propaganda, but of Jane Finn there was no mention. Suddenly, in a lull in the clatter of the room, he got one phrase entire. Whittington was speaking. "Ah, but you don't know Flossie. She's a marvel. An archbishop would swear she was his own mother. She gets the voice right every time, and that's really the principal thing." Tommy did not hear Boris's reply, but in response to it, Whittington said something that sounded like, "Of course, only in an emergency." Then he lost the thread again. But presently the phrases became distinct again, whether because the other two had insensibly raised their voices, or because Tommy's ears were getting more attuned, he could not tell. But two words certainly had a most stimulating effect upon the listener. They were uttered by Boris, and they were, "Mr. Brown." Whittington seemed to remonstrate with him, but he merely laughed.
"Why not, my friend? It is a name most respectable, most common. Did he not choose it for that reason? Ah, I should like to meet him, Mr. Brown."
There was a steely ring in Whittington's voice as he replied, "Who knows, you may have met him already."
"Pah," retorted the other, "that is children's talk, a fable for the police. Do you know what I say to myself sometimes? That he is a fable invented by the inner ring, a bogey to frighten us with. It might be so,
and it might not. I wonder,
or is it indeed true that he is with us and amongst us, unknown to all but a chosen few? If so, he keeps his secret well. And the idea is a good one, yes, we never know. We look at each other. One of us is Mr. Brown, which he commands, but also he serves, among us, in the midst of us. And no one knows which he is."
With an effort, the Russian shook off the vagary of his fancy. He looked at his watch.
"Yes," said Whittington, "we might as well go."
He called a waitress and asked for his bill. Tommy did likewise, and a few moments later was following the two men down the stairs. Outside, Whittington hailed a taxi and directed the driver to go to Waterloo. Taxis were plentiful here, and before Whittington's had driven off, another was drawing up to the curb, in obedience to Tommy's peremptory hand.
"Follow that other taxi," directed the young man. "Don't lose it."
The elderly chauffeur showed no interest. He merely grunted and jerked down his flag. The drive was uneventful. Tommy's taxi came to rest at the departure platform just after Whittington's. Tommy was behind him at the booking office. He took a first-class single ticket to Bournemouth. Tommy did the same. As he emerged, Boris remarked, glancing up at the clock,
"You are early. You have nearly half an hour."
Boris's words had aroused a new train of thought in Tommy's mind. Clearly, Whittington was making the journey alone, while the other remained in London. Therefore, he was left with a choice as to which he would follow. Obviously, he could not follow both of them unless... Like Boris, he glanced up at the clock, and then to the announcement board of the trains. The Bournemouth train left at 3:30. It was now 10 past. Whittington and Boris were walking up and down by the bookstall. He gave one doubtful look at them, then hurried into an adjacent telephone box. He dared not waste time in trying to get hold of Tuppence. In all probability, she was still in the neighbourhood of South Audley Mansions. But there remained another ally. He rang up the Ritz and asked for Julius Hirschheimer. There was a click and a buzz. Oh, if only the young American was in his room! There was another click, and then, "Hello!" in unmistakable accents came over the wire. "That you, Hirschheimer? Beresford speaking. I'm at Waterloo. I've followed Whittington and another man here. No time to explain. Whittington's off to Bournemouth by the 3:30. Can you get there by then?" The reply was reassuring. "Sure, I'll hustle." The telephone rang off. Tommy put back the receiver with a sigh of relief. His opinion of Julius's power of hustling was high. He felt instinctively that the American would arrive in time. Whittington and Boris were still where he had left them. If Boris remained to see his friend off, all was well. Then Tommy fingered his pocket thoughtfully. In spite of the carte blanche assured to him, he had not yet acquired the habit of going about with any considerable sum of money on him. The taking of the first-class ticket to Bournemouth had left him with only a few shillings in his pocket. It was to be hoped that Julius would arrive better provided. In the meantime, the minutes were creeping by. 3:15, 3:20, 3:25, 3:27. Supposing Julius did not get there in time? 3:29? Doors were banging. Tommy felt cold waves of despair pass over him. Then a hand fell on his shoulder. "Here I am, son. Your British traffic beats description. Put me wise to the crooks right away." "That's Whittington. There, getting in now, that big dark man. The other is the foreign chap he's talking to." "I'm on to them. Which of the two is my bird?" Tommy had thought out this question. "Got any money with you?" Julius shook his head, and Tommy's face fell. "I guess I haven't more than $300 or $400 with me at the moment," explained the American. Tommy gave a faint whoop of relief. "Oh, Lord, you millionaires, you don't talk the same language. Climb aboard the lugger. Here's your ticket. Whittington's your man." "Me for Whittington," said Julius darkly. The train was just starting as he swung himself aboard. "So long, Tommy!" The train slid out of the station. Tommy drew a deep breath. The man, Boris, was coming along the platform towards him. Tommy allowed him to pass, and then took up the chase once more. From Waterloo, Boris took the tube as far as Piccadilly Circus. Then he walked up Shaftesbury Avenue, finally turning off into the maze of mean streets round Soho. Tommy followed him at a judicious distance. They reached at length a small, dilapidated square. The houses there had a sinister air in the midst of their dirt and decay. Boris looked round, and Tommy drew back into the shelter of a friendly porch. The place was almost deserted. It was a cul-de-sac, and consequently no traffic passed that way. The stealthy way the other had looked round stimulated Tommy's imagination. From the shelter of the doorway, he watched him go up the steps of a particularly evil-looking house and rap sharply with a peculiar rhythm on the door. It was opened promptly. He said a word or two to the doorkeeper, then passed inside. The door was shut to again. It was at this juncture that Tommy lost his head. What he ought to have done, what any sane man would have done, was to remain patiently where he was and wait for his man to come out again. What he did do was entirely foreign to the sober common sense which was, as a rule, his leading characteristic. Something, as he expressed it, seemed to snap in his brain. Without a moment's pause for reflection, he too went up the steps and reproduced, as far as he was able, the peculiar knock. The door swung open with the same promptness as before. A villainous-faced man with close-cropped hair stood in the doorway. "Well," he grunted. It was at that moment that the full realization of his folly began to come home to Tommy, but he dared not hesitate. He seized at the first words that came into his mind. "Mr. Brown?" he said. To his surprise, the man stood aside.
"Upstairs," he said, jerking his thumb over his shoulder. "Second door on your left."
Chapter 8 The Adventures of Tommy. Taken aback though he was by the man's words, Tommy did not hesitate. If audacity had successfully carried him so far, it was to be hoped it would carry him yet farther. He quietly passed into the house and mounted the ramshackle staircase. Everything in the house was filthy beyond words. The grimy paper, of a pattern now indistinguishable, hung in loose festoons from the wall. In every angle was a grey mass of cobweb. Tommy proceeded leisurely. By the time he reached the bend of the staircase, he had heard the man below disappear into a back room. Clearly no suspicion attached to him as yet. To come to the house and ask for Mr. Brown appeared indeed to be a reasonable and natural proceeding. At the top of the stairs Tommy halted to consider his next move. In front of him ran a narrow passage with doors opening on either side of it. From the one nearest him on the left came a low murmur of voices. It was this room which he had been directed to enter. But what held his glance fascinated was a small recess immediately on his right, half concealed by a torn velvet curtain. It was directly opposite the left-handed door, and owing to its angle it also commanded a good view of the upper part of the staircase. As a hiding place for one, or at a pinch two men, it was ideal, being about 2 feet deep and 3 feet wide. It attracted Tommy mightily. He thought things over in his usual slow and steady way, deciding that the mention of Mr. Brown was not a request for an individual, but in all probability a password used by the gang. His lucky use of it had gained him admission. So far he had aroused no suspicion, but he must decide quickly on his next step. Suppose he were boldly to enter the room on the left of the passage. Would the mere fact of his having been admitted to the house be sufficient? Perhaps a further password would be required, or at any rate some proof of identity. The doorkeeper clearly did not know all the members of the gang by sight, but it might be different upstairs. On the whole, it seemed to him that luck had served him very well so far, but that there was such a thing as trusting it too far. To enter that room was a colossal risk. He could not hope to sustain his part indefinitely. Sooner or later he was almost bound to betray himself, and then he would have thrown away a vital chance in mere foolhardiness. A repetition of the signal knock sounded on the door below, and Tommy, his mind made up, slipped quickly into the recess and cautiously drew the curtain farther across so that it shielded him completely from sight. There were several rents and slits in the ancient material which afforded him a good view. He would watch events, and any time he chose, could, after all, join the assembly, modelling his behaviour on that of the new arrival. The man who came up the staircase, with a furtive, soft-footed tread, was quite unknown to Tommy. He was obviously of the very dregs of society. The low, beetling brows and the criminal jaw, the bestiality of the whole countenance were new to the young man, though he was a type that Scotland Yard would have recognised at a glance. The man passed the recess, breathing heavily as he went. He stopped at the door opposite and gave a repetition of the signal knock. A voice inside called out something, and the man opened the door and passed in, affording Tommy a momentary glimpse of the room inside. He thought there must be about 4 or 5 people seated round a long table that took up most of the space, but his attention was caught and held by a tall man with close-cropped hair and a short, pointed, naval-looking beard, who sat at the head of the table with papers in front of him. As the newcomer entered, he glanced up, and with a correct but curiously precise enunciation which attracted Tommy's notice, he asked, "Your number, comrade?"
14, Governor," replied the other hoarsely.
"Correct." The door shut again.
"If that isn't a Hun, I'm a Dutchman," said Tommy to himself. "And running the show darn systematically, too, as they always do. Lucky I didn't roll in. I'd have given the wrong number, and there would have been the deuce to pay. No, this is the place for me. Hello, here's another knock."
This visitor proved to be of an entirely different type to the last. Tommy recognised in him an Irish Sinn Féiner. Certainly Mr. Brown's organization was a far-reaching concern. The common criminal, the well-bred Irish gentleman, the pale Russian, and the efficient German master of the ceremonies. Truly a strange and sinister gathering. Who was this man who held in his finger these curiously variegated links of an unknown chain? In this case, the procedure was exactly the same. The signal knock, the demand for a number, and the reply, correct. Two knocks followed in quick succession on the door below. The first man was quite unknown to Tommy, who put him down as a city clerk, a quiet, intelligent-looking man rather shabbily dressed. The second was of the working classes, and his face was vaguely familiar to the young man. 3 minutes later came another, a man of commanding appearance, exquisitely dressed, and evidently well-born. His face again was not unknown to the watcher, though he could not for the moment put a name to it. After his arrival there was a long wait. In fact, Tommy concluded that the gathering was now complete, and was just cautiously creeping out from his hiding-place when another knock sent him scuttling back to cover. This last comer came up the stairs so quietly that he was almost abreast of Tommy before the young man had realized his presence. He was a small man, very pale, with a gentle, almost womanish air. The angle of the cheekbones hinted at his Slavonic ancestry, otherwise there was nothing to indicate his nationality. As he passed the recess, he turned his head slowly. The strange, light eyes seemed to burn through the curtain. Tommy could hardly believe that the man did not know he was there, and in spite of himself he shivered. He was no more fanciful than the majority of young Englishmen, but he could not rid himself of the impression that some unusually potent force emanated from the man. The creature reminded him of a venomous snake. A moment later his impression was proved correct. The newcomer knocked on the door, as all had done, but his reception was very different. The bearded man rose to his feet, and all the others followed suit. The German came forward and shook hands. His heels clicked together. "We are honoured," he said. "We are greatly honoured. I much feared that it would be impossible." The other answered in a low voice that had a kind of hiss in it. "There were difficulties. It will not be possible again, I fear. But one meeting is essential to define my policy. I can do nothing without Mr. Brown. Is he here?" The change in the German's voice was audible, as he replied with slight hesitation, "We have received a message. It is impossible for him to be present in person." He stopped, giving a curious impression of having left the sentence unfinished. A very slow smile overspread the face of the other. He looked round at a circle of uneasy faces.
"Ah, I understand. I have read of his methods. He works in the dark and trusts no one. But all the same, it is possible that he is among us now."
He looked round him again, and again that expression of fear swept over the group. Each man seemed eyeing his neighbour doubtfully. The Russian tapped his cheek.
"So be it. Let us proceed."
The German seemed to pull himself together. He indicated the place he had been occupying at the head of the table. The Russian demurred, but the other insisted.
"It is the only possible place," he said, "for number one. Perhaps number 14 will shut the door?"
In another moment Tommy was once more confronting bare wooden panels, and the voices within had sunk once more to a mere undistinguishable murmur. Tommy became restive. The conversation he had overheard had stimulated his curiosity. He felt that by hook or by crook he must hear more. There was no sound from below, and it did not seem likely that the doorkeeper would come upstairs. After listening intently for a minute or two, he put his head round the curtain. The passage was deserted. Tommy bent down and removed his shoes. Then, leaving them behind the curtain, he walked gingerly out on his stockinged feet, and kneeling down by the closed door, he laid his ear cautiously to the crack. To his intense annoyance, he could distinguish little more, just a chance word here and there if a voice was raised, which merely served to whet his curiosity still farther. He eyed the handle of the door tentatively. Could he turn it, by degrees, so gently and imperceptibly that those in the room would notice nothing? He decided that with great care it could be done. Very slowly, a fraction of an inch at a time, he moved it round, holding his breath in his excessive care. A little more, a little more still, would it never be finished? Ah, at last it would turn no farther. He stayed so for a minute or two, then drew a deep breath and pressed it ever so slightly inward. The door did not budge. Tommy was annoyed. If he had to use too much force, it would almost certainly creak. He waited until the voices rose a little, then he tried again. Still nothing happened. He increased the pressure. Had the beastly thing stuck? Finally, in desperation, he pushed with all his might, but the door remained firm, and at last the truth dawned upon him. It was locked or bolted on the inside. For a moment or two, Tommy's indignation got the better of him. "Well, I'm damned," he said. "What a dirty trick!" As his indignation cooled, he prepared to face the situation. Clearly, the first thing to be done was to restore the handle to its original position. If he let it go suddenly, the men inside would be almost certain to notice it. So, with the same infinite pains, he reversed his former tactics. All went well, and with a sigh of relief, the young man rose to his feet. There was a certain bulldog tenacity about Tommy that made him slow to admit defeat. Checkmated for the moment, he was far from abandoning the conflict. He still intended to hear what was going on in the locked room. As one plan had failed, he must hunt about for another. He looked round him. A little farther along the passage on the left was a second door. He slipped silently along to it. He listened for a moment or two, then tried the handle. It yielded, and he slipped inside. The room, which was untenanted, was furnished as a bedroom. Like everything else in the house, the furniture was falling to pieces, and the dirt was, if anything, more abundant. But what interested Tommy was the thing he had hoped to find, a communicating door between the two rooms, up on the left by the window. Carefully closing the door into the passage behind him, he stepped across to the other and examined it closely. The bolt was shot across it. It was very rusty and had clearly not been used for some time. By gently wriggling it to and fro, Tommy managed to draw it back without making too much noise. Then he repeated his former manoeuvres with the handle, this time with complete success. The door swung open, a crack a mere fraction, but enough for Tommy to hear what went on. There was a velvet portiere on the inside of this door which prevented him from seeing, but he was able to recognise the voices with a reasonable amount of accuracy. The Sinn Féiner was speaking. His rich Irish voice was unmistakable. "That's all very well, but more money is essential. No money, no results." Another voice, which Tommy rather thought was that of Boris, replied, "Will you guarantee that there are results?" "In a month from now, sooner or later, as you wish, I will guarantee you such a reign of terror in Ireland as shall shake the British Empire to its foundations." There was a pause, and then came the soft, sibilant accents of Number One.
"Good. You shall have the money. Boris, you will see to that."
Boris asked a question.
"Via the Irish-Americans and Mr. Potter, as usual?" "I guess that'll be all right," said a new voice with a transatlantic intonation. "Though I'd like to point out here and now that things are getting a mite difficult. There's not the sympathy there was, and a growing disposition to let the Irish settle their own affairs without interference from America."
Tommy felt that Boris had shrugged his shoulders as he answered,
"Does that matter, since the money only nominally comes from the States?"
"The chief difficulty is the landing of the ammunition," said the Sinn Féiner. "The money is conveyed in easily enough, thanks to our colleague here." Another voice, which Tommy fancied was that of the tall, commanding-looking man whose face had seemed familiar to him, said, "Think of the feelings of Belfast if they could hear you."
"That is settled, then," said the sibilant tones. "Now, in the matter of the loan to an English newspaper, you have arranged the details satisfactorily, Boris?"
"I think so."
"That is good. An official denial from Moscow will be forthcoming if necessary."
There was a pause, and then the clear voice of the German broke the silence.
"I am directed by Mr. Brown to place the summaries of the reports from the different unions before you. That of the miners is most satisfactory. We must hold back the railways. There may be trouble with the ASE."
For a long time there was a silence, broken only by the rustle of papers and an occasional word of explanation from the German. Then Tommy heard the light tap-tap of fingers drumming on the table.
"And the date, my friend?" said Number One.
"The 29th.
The Russian seemed to consider.
"That is rather soon."
"I know, but it was settled by the principal labor leaders, and we cannot seem to interfere too much. They must believe it to be entirely their own show."
The Russian laughed softly as they were mused.
"Yes, yes," he said, "that is true. They must have no inkling that we are using them for our own ends. They are honest men, and that is their value to us. It is curious, but you cannot make a revolution without honest men. The instinct of the populace is infallible."
He paused and then repeated, as though the phrase pleased him,
"Every revolution has had its honest men. They are soon disposed of, afterwards."
There was a sinister note in his voice. The German resumed.
"Climes must go. He is too far-seeing. Number 14 will see to that."
There was a hoarse murmur.
"That's all right, Governor."
And then, after a moment or two, "Suppose I'm nabbed."
"You will have the best legal talent to defend you," replied the German quietly. "But in any case you will wear gloves fitted with the fingerprints of a notorious housebreaker. You have little to fear."
"Oh, I ain't afraid, Governor. All for the good of the cause. The streets is going to run with blood, so they say."
He spoke with a grim relish.
"Dreams of it sometimes, I does. And diamonds and pearls rolling about in the gutter for anyone to pick up."
Tommy heard a chair shifted. Then Number One spoke.
"Then all is arranged? We are assured of success?"
"I think so."
But the German spoke with less than his usual confidence. Number One's voice held suddenly a dangerous quality.
"What has gone wrong?"
"Nothing, but—"
"But what?"
"The labor leaders. Without them, as you say, we can do nothing. If they do not declare a general strike on the 29th,
"Why should they not?"
"As you've said, they're honest. And in spite of everything we've done to discredit the government in their eyes, I'm not sure that they haven't got a sneaking faith and belief in it. But I know they abuse it unceasingly. But on the whole, public opinion swings to the side of the government. They will not go against it."
Again the Russian's fingers drummed on the table.
"To the point, my friend. I was given to understand that there was a certain document in existence which assured success."
"That is so. If that document were placed before the leaders, the result would be immediate. They would publish it broadcast throughout England and declare for the revolution without a moment's hesitation. The government would be broken finally and completely."
"Then what more do you want?"
"The document itself," said the German bluntly.
"Ah, it is not in your possession. But you know where it is?"
"No."
"Does anyone know where it is?"
"One person, perhaps. And we are not sure of that, even."
"Who is this person?"
"A girl."
Tommy held his breath.
"A girl?"
The Russian's voice rose contemptuously.
"And you have not made her speak? In Russia we have ways of making a girl talk."
"This case is different," said the German sullenly.
"How different?"
He paused a moment, then went on.
"Where is the girl now?"
"The girl?"
"Yes.
She is—"
But Tommy heard no more. A crashing blow descended on his head, and all was darkness. Chapter 9. Tuppence Enters Domestic Service. When Tommy set forth on the trail of the two men, it took all Tuppence's self-command to refrain from accompanying him. However, she contained herself as best she might, consoled by the reflection that her reasoning had been justified by events. The two men had undoubtedly come from the second-floor flat, and that one slender thread of the name Rita had set the young adventurers once more upon the track of the abductors of Jane Finn. The question was, what to do next? Tuppence hated letting the grass grow under her feet. Tommy was amply employed, and debarred from joining him in the chase, the girl felt at a loose end. She retraced her steps to the entrance hall of the mansions. It was now tenanted by a small lift boy, who was polishing brass fittings and whistling the latest air with a good deal of vigour and a reasonable amount of accuracy. He glanced round at Tuppence's entry. There was a certain amount of the gamin element in the girl. At all events, she invariably got on well with small boys. A sympathetic bond seemed instantly to be formed. She reflected that an ally in the enemy's camp, so to speak, was not to be despised. "Well, William," she remarked, cheerfully, in the best approved hospital early morning style, "getting a good shine up?" The boy grinned responsively. "Albert, miss," he corrected. "Albert be it," said Tuppence. She glanced mysteriously round the hall. The effect was purposely a broad one, in case Albert should miss it. She leaned towards the boy and dropped her voice. "I want a word with you, Albert." Albert ceased operations on the fittings and opened his mouth slightly. "Look, do you know what this is?" With a dramatic gesture, she flung back the left side of her coat and exposed a small enamelled badge. It was extremely unlikely that Albert would have any knowledge of it. Indeed, it would have been fatal for Tuppence's plans, since the badge in question was the device of a local training corps originated by the Archdeacon in the early days of the war. Its presence in Tuppence's coat was due to the fact that she had used it for pinning in some flowers a day or two before. But Tuppence had sharp eyes, and had noticed the corner of a threepenny detective novel protruding from Albert's pocket, and the immediate enlargement of his eyes told her that her tactics were good, and that the fish would rise to the bait. "American Detective Force," she hissed. Albert fell for it. "Lord," he murmured ecstatically. Tuppence nodded at him with the air of one who has established a thorough understanding. "Know who I'm after?" she inquired genially. Albert, still round-eyed, demanded breathlessly, "One of the flats?" Tuppence nodded and jerked a thumb up the stairs. "Number 20. Calls herself Vandermeer. Ha! Vandermeer. Ha, ha!" Albert's hand stole to his pocket. "A crook?" he queried eagerly. "A crook? I should say so. Ready Rita, they call her in the States." "Ready Rita?" repeated Albert deliriously. "Oh, ain't it just like the pictures?" It was. Tuppence was a great frequenter of the kinema. "Annie always said as how she was a bad lot," continued the boy. "Who's Annie?" inquired Tuppence idly. "House parlourmaid. She's leaving today. Many's the time Annie's said to me, 'Mark my words, Albert, I wouldn't wonder if the police was to come after her one of these days,' just like that. But she's a stunner to look at, ain't she?" "She's some peach," allowed Tuppence carelessly. "Finds it useful in her layout, you bet. Has she been wearing any of the emeralds, by the way?" "Emeralds? Them's the greenstones, isn't they?" Tuppence nodded. "That's what we're after her for. You know old man Risedale?" Albert shook his head. "Peter B. Risedale, the oil king? It seems sort of familiar to me. The sparklers belong to him. Finest collection of emeralds in the world, worth $1,000,000. "Lummy!" came ecstatically from Albert. "It sounds more like the pictures every minute." Tuppence smiled, gratified at the success of her efforts. "We haven't exactly proved it yet, but we're after her. And," she produced a long, drawn-out wink, "I guess she won't get away with the goods this time." Albert uttered another ejaculation indicative of delight. "Mind you, sonny, not a word of this," said Tuppence suddenly. "I guess I oughtn't to have put you wise, but in the States we know a real smart lad when we see one." "I'll not breathe a word," protested Albert eagerly. "Ain't there anything I could do? A bit of shadowing, maybe, or such like?" Tuppence affected to consider, then shook her head. "Not at the moment, but I'll bear you in mind, son. What's this about the girl you say is leaving?"
"Annie. Regular turn-up, they had. As Annie said, servants is somewhere nowadays and to be treated accordingly, and what with her passing the word round, she won't find it so easy to get another."
"Won't she?" said Tuppence thoughtfully. "I wonder..." An idea was dawning in her brain. She thought a minute or two, then tapped Albert on the shoulder. "See here, son, my brain's got busy. How would it be if you mentioned that you got a young cousin, or a friend of yours had, that might suit the place? You get me?"
"I'm there," said Albert instantly. "You leave it to me, miss, and I'll fix the whole thing up in two ticks."
"Some lad," commented Tuppence with a nod of approval. "You might say that the young woman could come in right away. You let me know, and if it's okay, I'll be round tomorrow at 11 o'clock.
"Where am I to let you know to?"
"Ritz," replied Tuppence laconically. "Name of Cowley." Albert eyed her enviously.
"It must be a good job, this tech business."
"It sure is," drawled Tuppence, "especially when old man Risedale backs the bill. But don't fret, son. If this goes well, you shall come in on the ground floor."
With which promise she took leave of her new ally and walked briskly away from South Audley Mansions, well pleased with her morning's work. But there was no time to be lost. She went straight back to the Ritz and wrote a few brief words to Mr. Carter. Having dispatched this, and Tommy not having yet returned, which did not surprise her, she started off on a shopping expedition, which, with an interval for tea and assorted creamy cakes, occupied her until well after 6 o'clock, and she returned to the hotel jaded, but satisfied with her purchases. Starting with a cheap clothing store, and passing through one or two second-hand establishments, she had finished the day at a well-known hairdresser's. Now, in the seclusion of her bedroom, she unwrapped that final purchase. 5 minutes later, she smiled contentedly at her reflection in the glass. With an actress's pencil, she had slightly altered the line of her eyebrows, and that, taken in conjunction with the new luxuriant growth of fair hair above, so changed her appearance that she felt confident that even if she came face to face with Whittington, he would not recognise her. She would wear elevators in her shoes, and the cap and apron would be an even more valuable disguise. From hospital experience, she knew only too well that a nurse out of uniform is frequently unrecognised by her patients. "Yes," said Tuppence aloud, nodding at the pert reflection in the glass. "You'll do." She then resumed her normal appearance. Dinner was a solitary meal. Tuppence was rather surprised at Tommy's non-return. Julius, too, was absent, but that, to the girl's mind, was more easily explained. His hustling activities were not confined to London, and his abrupt appearances and disappearances were fully accepted by the young adventurers as part of the day's work. It was quite on the cards that Julius P. Hersheimer had left for Constantinople at a moment's notice, if he fancied that a clue to his cousin's disappearance was to be found there. The energetic young man had succeeded in making the lives of several Scotland Yard men unbearable to them, and the telephone girls at the Admiralty had learned to know and dread the familiar "Hello!" He had spent 3 hours in Paris, hustling the prefecture, and had returned from there imbued with the idea, possibly inspired by a weary French official, that the true clue to the mystery was to be found in Ireland. "I dare say he's dashed off there now," thought Tuppence. "All very well, but this is very dull for me. Here I am, bursting with news, and absolutely no one to tell it to. Tommy might have wired or something. I wonder where he is. Anyway, he can't have lost the trail, as they say. That reminds me." And Miss Cowley broke off in her meditations and summoned a small boy. 10 minutes later, the lady was ensconced comfortably on her bed, smoking cigarettes and deep in the perusal of Garnaby Williams, The Boy Detective, which, with other threepenny works of lurid fiction, she had sent out to purchase. She felt, and rightly, that before the strain of attempting further intercourse with Albert, it would be as well to fortify herself with a good supply of local colour. The morning brought a note from Mr. Carter. "Dear Miss Tuppence, you've made a splendid start, and I congratulate you.
I feel, though, that I should like to point out to you once more the risks you are running, especially if you pursue the course you indicate. Those people are absolutely desperate and incapable of either mercy or pity. I feel that you probably underestimate the danger, and therefore warn you again that I can promise you no protection. You have given us valuable information, and if you choose to withdraw now, no one could blame you. At any rate, think the matter over well before you decide. If, in spite of my warnings, you make up your mind to go through with it, you will find everything arranged. You have lived for 2 years with Miss Dufferin at the Parsonage Llanelli, and Mrs. Vandermeer can apply to her for a reference. May I be permitted a word or two of advice? Stick as near to the truth as possible. It minimizes the danger of slips. I suggest that you should represent yourself to be what you are, a former VAD who has chosen domestic service as a profession. There are many such at the present time. That explains away any incongruities of voice or manner which otherwise might awaken suspicion. Whichever way you decide, good luck to you. Your sincere friend, Mr. Carter. Tuppence's spirits rose mercurially. Mr. Carter's warnings passed unheeded. The young lady had far too much confidence in herself to pay any heed to them. With some reluctance, she abandoned the interesting part she had sketched out for herself. Although she had no doubts of her own powers to sustain a role indefinitely, she had too much common sense not to recognize the force of Mr. Carter's arguments. There was still no word or message from Tommy, but the Morning Post brought a somewhat dirty postcard with the words, "It's OK," scrawled upon it. At 10:30, Tuppence surveyed with pride a slightly battered tin trunk containing her new possessions. It was artistically corded. It was with a slight blush that she rang the bell and ordered it to be placed in a taxi. She drove to Paddington and left the box in the cloakroom. She then repaired with a handbag to the fastnesses of the ladies' waiting room. Then, minutes later, a metamorphosed Tuppence walked demurely out of the station and entered a bus. It was a few minutes past 11 when Tuppence again entered the hall of South Audley Mansions. Albert was on the lookout, attending to his duties in a somewhat desultory fashion. He did not immediately recognize Tuppence. When he did, his admiration was unbounded. "Blessed if I'd have known you! That rig out's top hole!" "Glad you like it, Albert," replied Tuppence modestly. "By the way, am I your cousin or am I not?" "Your voice, too!" cried the delighted boy. "It's as English as anything." "No, I said as a friend of mine knew a young gal. Annie wasn't best pleased. She stopped on till today to oblige, she said. But really it's so as to put you against the place." "Nice girl," said Tuppence. Albert suspected no irony. "She's style about her and keeps her silver a treat. But my word, ain't she got a temper. Are you going up now, miss? Step inside the lift. Number 20, did you say?" And he winked. Tuppence quelled him with a stern glance and stepped inside. As she rang the bell of number 20, she was conscious of Albert's eyes slowly descending beneath the level of the floor. A smart young woman opened the door.
"I've come about the place," said Tuppence. "It's a rotten place," said the young woman without hesitation. "Regular old cat, always interfering. Accused me of tampering with her letters. Me! The flap was half undone anyway. There's never anything in the waste paper basket. She burns everything. She's a wrong one, that's what she is. Swell clothes, but no class. Cook knows something about her, but she won't tell. Scared to death of her. And suspicious? She's on to you in a minute if you so much as speak to a fella. I can tell you—" But what more Annie could tell, Tuppence was never destined to learn, for at that moment a clear voice, with a peculiarly steely ring to it, called, "Annie!" The smart young woman jumped as if she had been shot.
"Yes, ma'am? Who are you talking to?"
"It's a young woman about the situation, ma'am."
"Show her in, then, at once."
"Yes, ma'am."
Tuppence was ushered into a room on the right of the long passage. A woman was standing by the fireplace. She was no longer in her first youth, and the beauty she undeniably possessed was hardened and coarsened. In her youth she must have been dazzling. Her pale gold hair, owing a slight assistance to art, was coiled low on her neck. Her eyes, of a piercing electric blue, seemed to possess a faculty of boring into the very soul of the person she was looking at. Her exquisite figure was enhanced by a wonderful gown of indigo charmeuse.
And yet, despite her swaying grace and the almost ethereal beauty of her face, you felt instinctively the presence of something hard and menacing, a kind of metallic strength that found expression in the tones of her voice and in that gimlet-like quality of her eyes. For the first time, Tuppence felt afraid. She had not feared Whittington, but this woman was different. As if fascinated, she watched the long, cruel line of the red curving mouth, and again she felt that sensation of panic pass over her. Her usual self-confidence deserted her. Vaguely she felt that deceiving this woman would be very different to deceiving Whittington. Mr. Carter's warning recurred to her mind. Here indeed she might expect no mercy. Fighting down that instinct of panic which urged her to turn tail and run without further delay, Tuppence returned the lady's gaze firmly and respectfully. As though that first scrutiny had been satisfactory, Mrs. Vandermeer motioned to a chair.
"You can sit down. How did you hear I wanted a house parlour maid?"
"Through a friend who knows the lift boy here. He thought the place might suit me."
Again that basilisk glance seemed to pierce her through.
"You speak like an educated girl."
Glibly enough, Tuppence ran through her imaginary career on the lines suggested by Mr. Carter. It seemed to her as she did so that the tension of Mrs. Vandermeer's attitude relaxed.
"I see," she remarked at length. "Is there anyone I can write to for a reference?"
"I lived last with a Miss Dufferin, the parsonage, Llanethley. I was with her 2 years."
"And then you thought you would get more money by coming to London, I suppose. Well, it doesn't matter to me. I will give you £50, £60, whatever you want. You can come in at once?"
"Yes, ma'am. Today, if you like. My box is at Paddington."
"Go and fetch it in a taxi, then. It's an easy place. I'm out a good deal. By the way, what is your name?"
"Prudence Cooper, ma'am."
"Very well, Prudence. Go away and fetch your box. I shall be out to lunch. The cook will show you where everything is."
"Thank you, ma'am."
Tuppence withdrew. The smart Annie was not in evidence. In the hall below, a magnificent hall porter had relegated Albert to the background. Tuppence did not even glance at him as she passed meekly out. The adventure had begun, but she felt less elated than she had done earlier in the morning. It crossed her mind that if the unknown Jane Finn had fallen into the hands of Mrs. Vandermeer, it was likely to have gone hard with her.